Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining for our live streamed edition of Ask a Musa. So welcome to the Musas podcast. My name is Mia Garcia, and I'm the author of The Resolutions. Today, I'm joined by Angela Velez, Lake and Zaya Kemp, and Johnny Garzavilla. And today, on this episode of Ask a Musa, we'll be talking about anything and everything y'all want to ask. So thank you for joining us. And so let's start off with Angela. Can you start us off by introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about your book?
So my name is Angela Velez, and my book is Lulu and Milagro's Search for Clarity. It is a road trip novel featuring two sisters who are on a cross-country field trip to visit different college campuses. And one is dead set on going to an out-of-state college, and her mom thinks this is a terrible idea. And the other hasn't seen herself as college material, doesn't really get the hype. And over the course of a week, they will kind of figure out new things about themselves, about who they can be, but also like really break a lot of rules, wreak havoc all over these college campuses.
That is awesome. So, Laken, can you tell us a little bit about your book?
Okay, so my name is Laken Zaykev, and my debut novel, Somewhere Between Bitter and Sweet, came out on April 6th, so about a month ago. It's a story told in two voices. Pen is an aspiring pastry chef who dreams of continuing her father's cooking legacy, but her parents don't think that that's such a great idea, but the reasons for that are a little mysterious. On the one hand, it seems like they want her to pick something more practical. But on the other hand, it seems like there's something they're hiding from her about the restaurant itself, which may be why her father is so adamant about her not taking over the place. But Penn has secrets too. And when one of those secrets comes to light, it solidifies Penn's father's opinion that she doesn't belong at the restaurant, and he fires her. The same day, a new hire shows up. His name is Xander. And of course, they are, you know, making eyes at each other all night. But besides a romance developing between the two, their lives become even more intertwined when both the restaurant and Xander's immigrant status are threatened. And at that point, he and Penn must work together to save the place they both call home.
And it is awesome, and you should go buy it. So that's that. Johnny, can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming book?
Yeah, so my young adult debut novel is titled 1500 Miles from the Sun, and it looks like this. It is about Corpus Christi, Texas high school senior Julian, aka Jules Luna, who is just trying to get through his last year of high school and graduate and get into UCLA and be able to move away from his home and like all of the different things that have just kept him closeted his entire life, until all of those things kind of crash like right out the closet whenever he gets tremendously drunk at a party and accidentally comes out on Twitter. And so in the days and weeks and months that follow, Jules is going to find out all of the happiness and love that can come from living our true self, including being including a DM from his long distance crush in Los Angeles, as well as the pain and rejection that can come from living authentically. And yeah, that comes out in a couple weeks.
That is awesome. And I am about like almost halfway through the book, and it is wonderful. And I know I'm going to be destroyed by the second half of it based off of a lot of the online reactions. So I am prepared. Okay. I should also probably say what my book is about, because it feels like it was 2 years ago. So it's like a billion publishing lifetimes. So I'm Mia Garcia, author of The Resolutions, and The Resolutions is about four Puerto Rican teens who are heading into their senior year. And they're a little bit worried that they're going to be growing apart because of senior year and going to college. So they decide to do New Year's resolutions for each other. Like if I decided what Laken's resolutions were going to be for the year, and you had to do them throughout the year and the chaos that that would cause. That's essentially the book. So it follows those four friends through heartbreak and new loves and just a whole bunch of chaos and disaster, which is, I feel like, my wheelhouse, and also food. So put that in there. And we actually have our first question. So I am going to put it up on the screen. So what is the best part of drafting for you? Alternatively, what's the worst part? We're going to go in order. So Angela, can you kick us off?
So I would say the best part of drafting, I don't know if it exists. I like revision. I find it really tough when I'm still figuring things out. I don't love getting things wrong. And when I'm drafting, it's just cool getting things wrong and figuring it out. And I think the revision part where things become more clear is what I like more.
Awesome. Laken, do you want to talk about your favorite or worst part about drafting?
The best part of drafting is when it's done. Yeah, drafting is really tough. I say I have the most fun whenever I'm in the first 20% of the manuscript. And then that's when things start to lose steam a little bit and some of the real work happens of, you know, usually having to go back and fix things before I can move forward. So once that process starts, where I'm making discoveries that require me to backtrack, edit something I've already done before I can make any more progress, like that's when things slow down a lot. So that's probably the worst part, which is the majority of the process.
Johnny.
I actually really love drafting. I don't know if it's because I'm a Sagittarius or something, but like I get very like into and obsessive about new ideas just like so quickly. And like, I just love like getting into like a new main character and like a new setting and a new idea and all of those things. Like, it's just my favorite thing. I find it so easy to just like throw away all other responsibilities just for like a shiny new thing, just all the time. So I just love going into new ideas. I think the worst part is that like I'm usually a Cancer, and so by like the fifth chapter, I realize I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know what the plot is. Like, I just kind of was solely working on vibes, and like now I don't necessarily know exactly what the story I was trying to tell was. And so like trying to figure that out, and or just like throwing out any kind of idea that I can think of and just kind of like piling it all up until I can reach at least 75,000 words, like whichever one happens first.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate the vibes only approach to writing, which sort of feels like what an aesthetic is. I feel you, because I'm a Cancer that needs to be a plotter and sort of it was forced to be a plotter because my first two books were under contract and had to be written under a deadline. Whereas the book I was writing before that I'm still writing it and rewriting it because I've been pantsing it the whole way. And I've been like, on, as you said, like working on just vibes. I'm like, why is this character in the middle of the woods talking to a random witch that appeared? I don't know, but it feels cool. And I've been going on that vibe for like 10 years. Whereas the two books that it came out, I outlined them with my editor. I drafted them multiple times and I had like a set things of chapters I wanted to hit, and those actually got finished. So I feel like I'm constantly that Cancer that needs to be a plotter to actually complete a story. So I feel like that's the worst part for me, is that journey of, you know, you can't do this again. Start with some form of a plot or an outline. And actually the middle grade that I'm writing right now, I did sat myself down and forced myself to write even like the smallest of outline, just to see where I wanted to begin and wanted to end. And I could muddle a little bit around in the middle. But I'm about halfway through, and I don't think I would have been halfway through had I not forced myself to just write like a one paragraph. Like, what would you like to accomplish with this book for the love of everything? I think we had an IG question.
Oh, yeah, we do. So I can take that one. It's from the wonderful Terry. She is asking about translations, say a picture book translation or anything. Should it follow the special vocabulary and sayings of your country, or should it be more universal and reflect all Latinidad? That's a good question.
Oh, I think it depends on the rights sold, no? Like, am I understanding the question correctly in terms of...
I feel like it's more like when you're drafting something, like, do you make the choice to, like, write something that's more colloquial to like your own like nationality and even region, or do you stick to just like basic Spanish that anyone across like the Latina experience would be able to know?
That's an excellent question. I'd say for myself, I go with as specific as possible. And then sometimes when my copy editor or my editor don't understand, I'm like, it's fine, just skip over it. So Puerto Ricans will get this, don't worry about it. And then I'll check in with my siblings or my Puerto Rican friends, be like, this makes sense. Yes. Good. Okay. Because I always feel like that there is no universal Latina experience. And if we can be as specific and as true as possible to the characters that we're trying to portray, that universality is going to come through regardless of whether or not you understand what a specific saying is that is like either on the island or in the mainland versus like someone who's like diaspora or somebody who's lived there all their life and stuff like that. That's my opinion. Angela?
So I haven't worked in translation.
Do you have Spanish in your book?
I do have Spanish in my book. It's mostly adults talking to my characters. And then there's a scene where they're in San Francisco and they live in Baltimore. And so they don't typically encounter Spanish. And they talk a lot about how for them, Spanish has never been a whole world, like something that could connect them to another community, and kind of discovering that in San Francisco is this moment. I don't know if the Spanish is Peruvian specific. It might be. They do talk a lot about Peruvian food.
Lakin?
So I'm actually going to be going on sub soon with a picture book that it's like a bedtime story. And so I use a term that I know Johnny will be familiar with, but it's like a very Tejano specific term, and it's going mimis. And it's like a shortened form of dormir, which means to sleep. It's in the title and it shows up in the text several times. So we'll see. You know, what feedback I get from my editor. My agent has already, you know, seen the manuscript and she's giving me some feedback on it. But I do know that it is very specific. I don't know if anyone else on the panel, like Mia or Angela, I don't know if you've ever heard that term before.
I was literally just talking about it. And so, yeah, noted Boricua, Mia Garcia does know.
And never heard of it?
No, I had. We in Puerto Rico, or at least in my family, we use mimir. That's like the back part of dormir, so M-I-R. It's like my aunt will say, okay, pues, goodbye, I'm going to mimir. I'm like, all right. You're like a 75-year-old woman, but here we go. but yes, I had heard of it.
Okay. Yeah, so I know it's something that we use in Texas a lot, but I don't know how widely it's used elsewhere. I've never seen it in a book, at least like not a children's book or picture book, like the way that I'm planning on using it. So, like I said, we'll see what kind of feedback I get. And obviously, if they do buy it, like it'll be announced. And so you'll know that it was successful or not.
My family says tutu. I don't know why. I actually think that's Peruvian.
T-U, T-U?
Mm-hmm. Vamos a tutu.
That's cute.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of that.
It should just be a series of picture books of like, little words that mean sleep in different languages and different cultures. Johnny.
Like, I feel like if I was writing a picture book, which I don't think I would ever do, but if I was writing a picture book, I feel like I would probably want like a mix, like a general, if there are words that can like just generally be understood just as in Spanish, I think that would probably be helpful to just like development, like with children, but also like if you can add words that are specific to like a certain country or specific place, I think that'd be really cute. Like, I feel even 2 and 3 and 4 year olds should be able to see their specific selves in picture books. So that'd be a really cute way of doing it.
I will add, I have the slang of a 50-year-old because it's my parents' slang. So I don't know. That's also another reason I don't use it. When I use it around my cousins, they make fun of me because it's like how their parents talk.
I feel you. I'm not cool enough to know any up and coming slang today or tomorrow. But I also feel then that makes my book timeless in a way. There's no like timestamp on a particular saying on it because I don't know how to use it. I've never been cool, y'all. Sorry.
I asked my friend, like, who has a lot of cousins, like in like Laredo and like down in South Texas, like, how do your cousins who are like 17 through 19, how are they saying these words? What would they say? And so that was really helpful to get like exactly how those kinds of kids are talking.
How do you all like bring in such awesome, this is just a random, like, probably doesn't make any sense, but I'm thinking about your friendships and the dynamics and how you set the tone between characters that are not always necessarily POV characters, but they're very important in the terms of how you create the environment for your main character, like your ecosystem. Do those other family and friends just like show up along with your main POV, or do you just feel like, okay, my main character needs this as a best friend, like I want to see this in their journey, and then you sort of pluck in your best friends or your family in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so like TBH, I kind of shaped like Jules's friend group originally just off of On My Block. Like I saw like a main character, I saw three friends, I saw this wild girl like following them all the time, like I'll just do that. Like the personalities of course are different, but like that's a good friend group, and I'll just kind of create like that's a good number, like three main ones and then maybe at least one like secondary friend, maybe another one, but that's how I'll do it. And so like I stuck with that. I thought that was a really good idea, and then just kind of like I voice wasn't a thing that like came to me naturally, and so it was just kind of like a building thing of like, why does every single one of Jules's friends sound the exact same? And like, okay, like let's fix that. And like, I think a big part of it was going to those specific moments where it's just like Jules and one particular friend by themselves, and like how they're interacting and like what emotions are coming out of that, and just like building on that specifically, aside from like all of them just kind of like in their own pen that he's all together. And I made birth charts for all of them too, and that helped me get like what their personalities were.
I think that's should be a new craft technique, is making birth charts.
Yeah, and like astrological signs. Writing this book has made me an astrology gay, and like there's just no way.
Lakin?
Sometimes I'll come up with secondary characters or a supporting cast based on personality traits or like interests and hobbies that I don't have enough room to explore with the main character. And maybe I still want those things incorporated into the book somehow. With Somewhere Between Bitter and Sweet, there were actually some characters who were based on or inspired by real people. For example, there's a character named Struggles, and he's, well, of course, that's his nickname. But he's just like this scrawny kid who works in the dish pit, like the lowest rung of the ladder in terms of the restaurant staff. And that is based on a real person who worked at the restaurant that inspired the book, where my partner worked for several years when we were teenagers. And I mean, that was just such an incredible nickname. Like I had to create a character named Struggles. So sometimes it'll be something in real life that inspires one of those characters. Sometimes it's just a particular interest or personality that I want to explore more.
Angela?
For me, when I was working with the sisters, I knew I wanted them to be in direct opposition to each other. And so every time I worked on one character, I was kind of like essentially working on the other, because I knew they were going to be the total opposite. And this, with friend groups, especially with the second book, I'm finding that often our friends can kind of fill in the gaps. Like if you are a cautious person, you usually have like an adventurous person in your group. If you are full of emotion, there's usually a counterpart friend that's like, okay, let's talk this out. We can walk back from this. It's going to be okay. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. I want there to be minimal chaos, except for when the plot creates it. And then when everyone's wires are crossed, like it implodes. Mm. Like a delicate balance, basically.
I feel you. For the resolutions, because they were four main characters and they were all simultaneously the main POV at one time and then the hovering environment and every other time when the other POVs would go forward. So they were all sort of playing this little like tango with each other any particular time when we're discussing a particular POV. I really wanted to, I grew up with all of the teen movies on TV and all those friendships and they're going on hijinks and yada yada yada. But I really wanted to see that with the community that I had grown up in. So that's essentially the base that just like those weird conversations that like come out of nowhere that reference something that was like from 2 years ago, the eternal text conversation that just goes down to like when they first met each other and no one's deleted anything and the record is there. I really wanted to create that sort of, type of friendship that you knew that they would, could be fighting one moment, but like, go like if someone needed someone to like kick someone's butt, like the other three would be there in like 5 seconds, sort of friendship that I had loved seeing on in movies and TV growing up. So I actually have a wonderful question here from Nina Moreno that says, how do you keep track of story ideas? Do you have ones you don't feel ready to write yet? I'm gonna go randomly to Lakin.
Okay, so I saw, I think on Pinterest, people were making some really cool like desktop organizers. So I did that maybe a few summers ago. And so I have like a label for what's under contract, what are my like works in progress. And then below that, I have all the age categories broken up in different folders and different documents plopped in there. So that's how I try to keep track of them. They usually start out like just being chaotically, you know, disorganized in the notes app in my phone. And then I have to transfer everything over to my laptop, like whenever I have time and I think to do that. There are some stories that I do feel like, not necessarily that I don't have all the skills that I need, but I just don't have the time yet. One of those is like a high fantasy series that I've drafted part of and have been sort of picking at for maybe like 5 or 6 years. And so that's something that intimidates me just in terms of like the scope and the time that I know that I'm going to need to actually work on it and build out the world. Because I'm used to writing a lot of contemporary, you know, I've written paranormal romance in the past when I was self-pubbing. So I have some experience with world building, but not to this degree that I would be doing. So that's something that's still sitting in my queue and just waiting for like the right break in my production schedules and like a right break, the right break in between contracts for me to really be able to dig into it.
Angela?
I have a disastrous notes app, sort of. And I have like once, and I return to them. So they have different, like each is a new note. And I know that a story has meet when I keep coming back to it and adding to it. And like right before I go to sleep, I think of another sentence. And there are a few where I realize like the idea is so exciting, but like maybe it's not necessarily for me. I really want to do a music book, like, and I know you've got one, but like I'm so tone deaf and it's like, I don't know if I can ever get there. I'm trying, but I'm realizing that's going to take a little longer, for example. I also realized like in the pandemic, it was hard to imagine being anywhere but Pittsburgh. And so I've kind of found myself writing a Pittsburgh book, which I never thought would happen. But that's kind of another example of I just kept coming back to this one notes idea.
Johnny?
Most of mine are like just like shelved ideas that just didn't get done that I would like to come back at some point to, maybe one day. And a couple of them are just ones that I felt like I haven't come to a place where I can write them. Like one was a project I did in the second half of November for NaNoWriMo that was like a thriller, a YA thriller. And like, I just couldn't wrap my head over like how to do that. And I tried like four different times, just restarting it and trying to figure it out. And it just wasn't happening. So I just was like, no, like I can't, this isn't happening right now. Like I'll come back to it later when maybe like my head is in a better place to write something like this. And also there's like this, I really want to do this like scarier story of like, now watch vampires that I like read about once. And I was like, I think this should exist, but like, I do not like scary stuff. And so like, I don't know if I'm the person to write it, but I'll, or maybe just like, I don't know. I'll figure it out one day maybe. But yeah, I think those are just the main, I'm comfortable in contemporary right now. So, and I feel like I'll be there for a minute. So we're just gonna stick with that.
I hear you. I've kept like a small notebook, for example, for picture book ideas, because those are usually easy to write down in an overall paragraph or like, I want to remember this. But for example, I do have this book that I have been, speaking of ideas that we don't feel either comfortable or ready to write, whether we know it or not. I have a somewhere between a magical realism to possibly historical fantasy book that I've been writing for over 10 years on and off. Hasn't probably been 10 years all together, but it's sort of, I've put it down, wrote Even If the Sky Falls, picked it back up, wrote it, put it back down, wrote the resolutions. And each time I felt like I figured out another piece of the puzzle of what the book was supposed to be. Because for the longest time I was like, what is this book about? Everybody's just like walking around the woods talking. No one's figured anything out yet. And then like every time I would pick it back up, I'd say, okay. So that's what this is about. So that I think there's certainly some ideas that require that that constant like trip up and constant like walking around trying to figure out what these characters want to do or what they're doing. And also like as you, every time you write a book, every time that you are putting a story down, you are working on your craft and you're becoming a better writer, whether you realize it or not, right? If the Lakin who is now on their second book went back to somewhere between bitter and sweet, they probably would adjust a lot of things or would add different things or write that book differently because you've also grown as a writer as you continue to go, forward. So I think some ideas, to what Angela said, if you keep coming back to it and you still feel something, it doesn't matter how long it's taken you. It's like taking you however long it's supposed to. If you still like, I still go back to that book that's taken me 10 years plus to finish. And I'm like, oh, I still like this. Like, I still feel the aesthetic. I still feel the vibes. It just is like, I know that there's more to do and more that I need to work on. So yeah, the books take whatever time they need to take, y'all. It really is annoying. this is an interesting question since we're in different sort of like, so do you often think about what happens after your debut year? And do you plan for what could happen after the first year, either with life or work or the future? So Johnny and Lakin, you're both in your debut year. Angela, you're coming up to it. Time passes. And I'm like 2 years, well, actually no, debut year. Oh my God, it was 2016. Holy guacamole. Okay. So I'm going to throw it over to y'all. Whoever wants to kick it off.
Lakin, you go first. Your book's already out.
Okay. I guess I'm going to answer this question in terms of like a practical sense. I used to be an ESL teacher. And that's what I did before I started writing full time. And so I was teaching during the height of the pandemic and did all that virtual stuff where we had to leave campus and teach from home. You know, it was so stressful and terrible. And I knew that the fall semester was going to be a lot of the same. So over that summer break, I was thinking a lot about what was going to happen after my debut. And, you know, I sold the book in a 2-book deal. So I was thinking about that book. I was thinking about other things that I had recently finished or things that I knew that I would finish by the time the debut came out. And I was really thinking of it in terms of contracts and advance payments and figuring out if I might be able to make the switch to write full-time in terms of finances because of the pandemic. And that really pushed me to, you know, look for an escape route of some sort. And I sort of had one because of the two book deal with Little Brown. And so that's kind of how I've continued to plan things, thinking in terms of building a backlist as quickly as possible. So I've sold, you know, I sold a middle grade novel, I sold two picture books, and then this summer I'll be going out on sub with two more picture books. I'll be going out on sub with an early graphic novel. I'll be going out on sub with a novel in verse. And so I am just like, you know, obviously writing all the freaking time. But I worked out the math and figured out that I need to sell something every 6 to 8 months in order to be able to continue to write full time, or else, you know, I might have to rejoin the workforce, either get a part-time job or go back into the classroom. And so like, that's what I'm thinking about in terms of planning, in terms of like life, work, and future. I don't know if that's exactly what this question was asking about, but that's my answer, I guess.
I just want to add that Lakin's math is on her blog, and it's like really helpful as someone who is totally new to contracts and selling and all of that. So if that's something you wonder about, I really think you should read that. It's really good.
I didn't realize how many things you were going on submission with. I can't, like my heart's, my stomach went boom to the bottom of my belly. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's a lot. But what Angela just mentioned about the blog, I think in another life, I probably would have been like a financial advisor, because I just really love talking about money. And I think especially in our industry, everything is so just opaque. And like, I understand no one wants to talk about advance sizes. No one wants to talk about financial planning in regards to like contracting and being self-employed. But there are strategies that we should be sharing with each other to do things like lower our taxes, or to create like a writing routine that does allow you to go on sub more often. So yeah, I blog about those things. Sometimes I hope that I'll be able to get back to regular blogging soon, now that debut month has passed. But yeah, if you ever have like money questions related to publishing or anything like that, I love talking about that kind of stuff. So definitely reach out to me.
Johnny.
I'm lucky enough to have had like another deal secured pretty recently. So I will be able to like transition into that and like think of 2023, like right after. But also like, I don't like, it's not only on my mind yet, but like the thought of just then transitioning into like these characters that have been my entire personality for the past 2.5 years, now like not being like the first and foremost fictional characters that like come to mind now. Now I'm transitioning into these new characters who are going to be priority and who I talk about and who thrive in my mind and all of that, which is weird. Like, I don't know how I'm going to handle it emotionally, but like, we'll get through it, I guess. I'm just going to, I guess, look towards my sophomore novel and the multiple projects that I get to work on right now, that like, I don't know if when I'll talk about those. I have projects I'm drafting and revising and my agent is expecting, and like things I get to work on with friends and stuff like that. So yeah, like that's just kind of what I'm going to do. And, you know, maybe just like be able to live a little bit more quietly after, like, I don't have to talk about my book every day once like June or July or whatever. I guess after the year's over, like, you know, Right after June ends, like, it's like the next Heritage Month. So I guess, like, at the end of the year, I can stop talking about my book. But, like, yeah, that's when October 17th is when I think debut year will officially end for us.
No. I'm going to stop you right there. It has been 2 years since the resolutions came out, and I have not stopped talking about that book. Not well, to like, scare
like,
y'all.
Just like as frivolously as I do. Like, I don't have to annoy the timeline anymore with it. I can just do it like once a week now instead of like,
yes,
forcing TikToks on my timeline that remind me of my book and stuff like that.
I haven't seen your TikToks. You should be forcing them more.
Well, like, I see TikToks that aren't mine, and I'll like download them and put them on Twitter and be like, oh my god, this is my characters. Like, gosh, how relatable. And like that kind of stuff.
That's a great marketing technique.
Oh yeah, like my agent has been like, this is incredible. And I was like, I don't know, I'm just having fun. I don't know.
Anela?
So I had a 2-book deal. So for me, what happens after my debut is I have to hit that deadline. And that's mostly what I'm thinking about and has guided some of my definitely planning decisions. Similar to Lakin, after the pandemic, once the pandemic happened, my workload basically doubled and I realized it wouldn't be possible to do my job, which was advising students and write the book. And so I was pretty sad to say goodbye to them. I'm really thrilled to write this book. Something I look forward to with after the debut is kind of finally finding that balance of like a part-time job or freelance, or so I miss that one-on-one student interaction. And advising was a surprisingly fun job. I did it after my grad school program ended, and I would recommend it to anyone. You hang out with college students and you give them advice, which is like, I would say among my friends, I tend to give too much advice, and here I was being paid to do it. And so that was ideal. And I'd love to either do that or get back into teaching in some way, but find a better balance than what I found myself in March or April of last year.
I feel you. I was working full time with the resolutions and after, and I feel like the fact that I was working full time during that entire time until about the end of last year was the reason why it's taken me so long to do another project. I didn't have anything contracted either, so I would like to come back to the 2-book deal stress at some point, which I think many of us can speak about. But it is a hard balance to you're working full time and you're writing, but you're also marketing a book at the same time. And a lot of people don't feel like they talk about the fact that marketing a book while you're writing a book, it's just like 3 full-time jobs essentially. Because a lot of people who, you know, being published is an amazing, wonderful thing, but not everybody gets marketing dollars placed behind those books. So a lot of the times you do have to be sort of a marketer and publicity person for yourself, and that can take an emotional toll on you as well. So I always, when people ask me how to, what they can do for their book, and I always say like, well, you need to look at the amount of time you have in your life, either emotionally and physically, and the things that you can do, and try not to like overdo it, because it's very easy to look at what everybody else is getting and what everybody else is doing and feeling that you have to do those things as well. But there's just simply like not enough time in the day. So I was very lucky that at the time that I was doing the resolutions, my job was very like open, was very like, do when like, you're doing your job. We don't really care. Like if you need to take an hour to do a school visit, or if you need to take a day for like a festival, you're like, we trust you. And they were a wonderful group of people and really lucky to have worked with them during that time. But yeah, it becomes like this really weird balancing act that I feel like you don't really see it until you're like out of it, where you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. And it's not always like, you can't always duplicate it essentially. So I always say, like, look at your life as a budget, or Johnny, I think you use sometimes spoons, like how many spoons you have to put out in a day and in a week and in a month, and do what you can and have a lot of fun, because, you know, you wrote a book, you got it published, it's out in the world, people are reading it, and that is a whole lot of awesome right there. So just a reminder, we have a fun, oh, good.
That was submitted through the Q&A function on IG. How do you push past negative writer's block after a tough critique or deal with imposter syndrome?
I can go first. I get angry. Anger. Just straight off the bat, anger. Like, how dare you? And then once I've like had my emotional outburst, then I come back in and see if it's like a critique that I can work with or completely off base. And that's usually what I do when with edit letters, that's when I get like emotionally first, all the emotions out, and then I come back and look like, okay, I can address this. This I don't agree with, and this I can move forward with. And then I get to work. And that literally has not changed for every book. It's always emotional out, but like whatever the five steps are, like anger, denial, acceptance, moving forward. That's my routine, and it's never changed. I can ask any of my creative partners, like, just get angry and then move forward. And that's how I work. Lakin, do you want to go next?
I've actually been having a really difficult time with my sophomore book, which I think is pretty typical. A lot of writers share within the community how the sophomore book is just really, really tough, especially if you're working on it at the same time that your first book is out and people are consuming it, they're giving you feedback on it, you know, while you're trying to draft something new. And so I've been struggling with a lot of self-doubt. I had to write this manuscript really quickly. And with every pass, even once I got to the revision stage with my editor, with every pass, I wasn't feeling it coming to fruition the way that I really wanted it to. And so I've been having a lot of fears about it being terrible and like not being as good as my first book. but I got past pages a few days ago. And basically past pages are once the book is formatted, and it's still a PDF, but the styling looks the way that it will look once it's printed into a physical copy. And so it's kind of the first time that you get to see your book like in the process of being born, like into a real physical book that you'll eventually be able to buy and hold. And I don't know what it is, but now that I'm rereading the story, I'm like, this is really good. and so I don't know how to replicate that if you're not writing under contract, if you're not writing for publication just yet. But, you know, it could be for me, it could be a combination of, you know, the short break that I got after I finally turned in copy edits, and between, you know, them sending me past pages. It could just be, you know, that time that I stepped away from the manuscript. It could just be, you know, that things are kind of calming down in my life in terms of like all the debut and all the work that I had to do in the month of April for that. So I don't know if there's, you know, something that you can do to check in with yourself mental health wise. If you know that there are certain things that really work for you to lift your mood. For me, going on really long walks is one of those things. And I'm talking like 2-3 hour walks, like I'll go for the entire morning. So anything like that that you can do to shift your mental and emotional state before you revisit the manuscript. So like I said, whether that's taking time away or like doing a specific activity that works for you, I feel like that might help.
Johnny?
So with negative, like tough critiques, I don't know if I necessarily get like writer's block after negative critiques. And I think it's more just because like I realize that like I am usually in a place where I've either asked like a critique partner to just read it and give me their honest advice. And they're usually I'm lucky to be surrounded by like people who are much smarter than I am, reading my books. And like, if it's not my critique partner, it's my agent who I pay to give me honest advice, or it's an editor who pays me to give me honest advice. And so like, these are people that I just ask to do that for me. So I don't really like get super butthurt about it, but I also, I mean, I do, like, I don't take criticism well, I know this, but I'm the type of person too, if it's this sort of thing, like the first thing in my head is like, well, you know what? I'm going to make it better. And then you're going to like it next time. And like, who's going to be the winner now? Like I will. And so that's kind of my frame of mind, where it's like, you don't like it right now, but you will, and I'll make you like it. And so that's like, that's where my mind is. It's not really on writer's block. It's like, I'm going to own this right now. And like, and that's just going to be it. That's just where my head is. But with imposter syndrome, like, ew, that's, it's just, yeah, imposter syndrome is horrible. And I don't know, like, it's a process, I think, of just growing into a writer that is comfortable writing whatever it is that is like imposter syndroming in your head. Like whenever I wrote 1500 Miles from the Sun, there was a lot of imposter syndrome about, am I Mexican enough to be writing this book? Am I even queer enough to be writing this book? Is like, is, and does anyone even want coming out stories anymore? Because there's a lot of noise about like, we have moved past the need of the society for coming out stories. And so there are a lot of just voices in my head and even outwardly that were just like on me all the time. And like, you just, I don't know, you just kind of, it's just a process of just writing the book however you can and then allowing yourself to grow and allowing that manuscript to grow with you. It by no means was my book perfect the first or second or even third draft. It took more and more times to figure out like not only my characters but also me as a person and like the confidence in myself and my identities and being able to show that on paper. Like it's taken years to do that since, you know, they finished this. So don't, you know, just like, we'll get over it. We'll get past the imposter syndrome. And you'll see yourself improve. Like my second book, like my agent told me on my second book, like they were like, you really just floored it with the Mexican stuff and the queer stuff, huh? And I was like, yeah, I guess I kind of did, huh? And so like, once you get over that, like you're going to be so unstoppable and it's going to be terrific. And I also like really love consuming media that inspires me whenever I'm having a hard time. So like if I want to go watch On My Block, or if I go watch Hentified, or if I when I read Darius the Great Is Not Okay after drafting 300 Miles from the Sun, and like looked at how Adib Karam was doing like language and not italicizing them, and how he brought in culture and stuff like that, like that gave me so much confidence to write my own culture. So it's just like finding things that inspire you and just move you in a way that will help progress your manuscript, I think, is a tool for getting past imposter syndrome.
Yeah, and as you mentioned earlier, which I always try to say, is spite is a wonderful motivator.
Oh yeah, literally, like I think all of my books have been written because of hatred, and that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Like do it out of spite. Like how dare you? Specifically when, or especially when those CCBC numbers come out. And people try to say like, oh, there's too many X of book. And you're like, absolutely, actually, there is not. And here is the data.
Yeah, like I cannot not say that my second book, On There Is Something We're Here, was not like propelled forward because I was drafting it at the same time American Dirt came out. And like, I just could not stand that book existing and I needed something better. And I was like, well, I'm drafting something better right now. So here we go. Like, intense dislike will help you.
Angela?
I kind of throw myself into new hobbies that I'm really not good at. And so if you've been following me on Instagram, that's why all of a sudden I'm into skating and sewing. Because I find like, if I can remember that joy of creating, or like I'm really messed up, all of a sudden writing a page becomes easier than like figuring out how to cut a buttonhole. And so it's just kind of like giving yourself that little bit of confidence and remembering that like messing up is okay. And also a page, a chapter, a book takes so long to like perfect, and having these tiny achievements, whether it's I learned how to spin on my skates, or like I can sew a pillow, or I walked an extra half hour and saw a new block, I'm like slowly conquering my neighborhood. Like I kind of like that. And then when I come back to the not so great critique, it doesn't feel as harsh, or I feel more equipped to take it on. So get lots of hobbies.
I love that. And you don't have to be good at them either, which you're actually wonderful, because I've seen all your Instagram videos and I was like, this is exactly the friend as a plus size woman. This is the exact friend I've always wanted. Where it's like, can you make me this shirt, please? I can't find it in my size. So there's actually two questions, one on Instagram and one here, that I think actually work together. So I'm going to bring it up. So this one reads, what would be the desired fan fiction you would want to see your characters in? Like, who would you drop in fan fiction? And actually, Cristal wrote here, is what are some YA tropes you'd love to see more in Latine stories. And I feel like those two might be combined a little bit or might work together. For myself, I would drop my characters probably in a Stranger Things sort of weird town scenario, because I love, even though my first two books are contemporary, I love speculative fiction, like horror, science fiction, fantasy, weird, just things happening here and there, magical realism. Like, I love it. And I haven't, my short story in Our Shadows Have Claws is the first time that I'm publicly writing speculative fiction to be published. So I'm very excited and nervous about that, because I feel most people know me just for contemporary with no weird things or shenanigans happening. So that's where I would drop my characters. And that's, I would love to see more Latine speculative fiction of all of the genres, just more. I'm going to start with Johnny, actually.
I'll go like on the trope one first. I completely agree. Like, my favorite thing to read is like speculative contemporary books, like anything Adam Silvera writes, obviously, like They Must Die at the End and like History's All You Left Me, right? Yeah, sure. No, More Happy Than Not. Like, where like society is like exactly contemporary, but there's just like this one thing that's different, and like it changes the whole scope of like what reality is. And even like Alex's book, The Grief Keeper, like one of my absolutely favorite books, and just like how society's the same except for like here's this thing that can take emotions from one person to the other. Like, I think that's so incredible. Like, they literally invented Black Mirror, and like I love stuff like that. I love stuff like that. There needs to be more of it. For the fan fiction one, if I had to like do like a crossover thing, I've already talked to Anna Mediano, because like I think like seeing like my soccer boys, like Jules and Jordan and Pina, like involved in some sort of Quidditch situation, like would be the funniest thing ever. And then I also recently finished Blaze Wrath Games, and like Amparo and I were having a conversation, like, okay, like of my characters, who plays what position now? I need to know like if they were all a team, like what position is Jules playing? What position is Matt playing? Like, who's the one riding the dragon and scoring the points here? So like, I would love to see, I mean, I wouldn't see it, like, we can't read fanfiction, but, like, in a cuter world, like, I would love to see that.
Macon?
Maybe because I mentioned high fantasy earlier, I would love to see more Latine high fantasy, really to see, like, what exactly that would look like. Yeah, we've been talking about Amparo's books, which I think are a really great example of taking specific cultural components and world building with that, instead of always necessarily like having to use European analogs all the time. I think there's a lot of potential out there to create some things that people have never seen before that will obviously be familiar to like our community, but, and for that reason be very special, but for, you know, the general public, I think would be really exciting for them to see and be able to read about. What was the other part of the question? Fan fiction?
Fan fiction, yeah.
So I have been seeing all the Instagram posts of the new book Blackout. Maybe you guys can help me like remember all the authors who are contributing to that book. Nick Stone, Angie Thomas, Danielle Clayton.
Nicola Yoon. There's one more. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I just think, like, the possibilities for multiple authors to collaborate on something is really exciting, and I think really honors and would fit in really well with just how our community operates in general. We're a community that is really great at working together towards common goals, and we see that all the time in terms of like community activism and especially in art. And I think to see that in literature, in something that is not quite an anthology, but more like a single book, right? It's not an anthology,
but no, it's like interconnected.
Yeah, it's all these interconnected stories. I just think that would be really cool if that became like a more regular thing. And I think it fits really well with the Latine community and lots of communities of color who are already used to collaborating like that in terms of art.
I think the word is co-authored essentially, even though there's five of them. I feel like that is the word. Angela,
I have two things. I would love to see more just like multi-generational families featured in books where kids are living, high school students are living with aunts and cousins, like all under one roof. I think it's just such a fun and unique family dynamic that creates a lot of chaos and gossip and secrets. I also would love to see more like new adult kind of college sort of story. So those are, yeah, those are the two tropes I'd like to see more.
I was working in publishing when the whole new adult term came about, and I felt like a deep sigh when someone mentions new adult, because there was like all of this marketing meetings of like, how do we make this happen? How do we work with new adult? Like, I still don't know. It's been like 10 years. I still don't know. I still don't know how to figure out new adult. I'd love to see it. We have a really a good question here from Instagram that says, any tips for writing dual POV books? Johnny, yours is one POV.
One, yeah.
Angela, yours is two or one? Two. And then Lincoln, you also have two. I have four.
So y'all take this one.
And there's also a really good convo on the Musa's YouTube that myself and Jenny Torres Sanchez and Alex Villasante did on dual POV as well, if you're all interested on that. But my main thing when I was doing the four POVs for my four main characters was that each one of them had to have a north in their story, an emotional point or a something that they really loved that was always give me a shortcut into getting into their mind. For example, Ryan is his story is about heartbreak and his story about being an artist, and his particular art is painting. So I would immerse myself in painting techniques. I would watch YouTube video of artists working on their acrylics or oils like that. Lee is like a giant nerd, like film references left and right. Hers was more into references and comic books and just finding a shortcut into their particular way of seeing the world, because all of the characters essentially will see the world in a different way. And the way that they see that world is how they're going to guide that chapter for you. So yeah, so that's how I figured out my four characters. They each had a little way of getting in. Sometimes it was something as simple as Nora loved to bake. So I would always start the chapter with some form of ingredients or mentioning sugar or mentioning how much she loved Beth. And that was like, and I'm in. And that's how I found her each time that I had to go into her character. So just like focus on something that will, a shortcut, essentially.
Lakin? So I like to focus on the lens through which that character sees the world. And those lenses should be very different, you know, shaped by their upbringing, their cultural background, their personalities. We were talking earlier about astrological charts. You can include that in there too if you want. I think to kind of narrow it down, the way they view the world needs to be really affected by some kind of insecurity they have, or maybe even some kind of trauma that they've experienced. It's usually not something positive, at least in the books that I write. It's usually something negative that shapes their worldview. And I just start from there. And so everything that they see, everything that they interact with, they're coming at it from that place of that perception. And oftentimes that perception that they have of the world is not entirely accurate. They have some kind of false belief that is actually hindering them or holding them back in some way. And so their journey through the story is usually them coming to realize that what they believed in the beginning is not necessarily true.
Excellent. Awesome.
So with dual POV, first I will say highly recommend, because it's two short books instead of one long book. It's great. Second, I think of with dual POV, like I agree there's a north and there's all these kind of like death-like vibes you can get in. But for me, they are magnets. And so one character wants something, and the POV for the next character, next chapter starts off with them ruining what this person wanted. And they're just kind of like constantly fighting with each other. And that propels them forward and the plot as well. And I think that thinking about what they want and also how the other one can ruin can kind of get me in their vibe and in their mood. They're kind of like their own disasters until they figure out how to work together, of course. But that can create the action, because I tend to kind of hang in my character's thoughts too long. And so I'm like, okay, we got to create some trouble.
I love that you said you're writing a shorter book because there's two POVs. You ready? I love that. I would also recommend, if you're thinking of doing dual POV or multiple POVs, 3, 4, a good exercise might be to write the same scene from those different POVs and really explore the emotional and the physical differences in your characters, and just sort of like essentially, you know, giving them a little play from those both sides and seeing how those emotions are playing out, and how they're, as Lakin said, how they're viewing the world and how it's different from that other person. And you're also very interestingly seeing the same scene play out from those two points of views and seeing a new, fresh perspective on it.
Someone did ask, what is everyone's favorite food to eat when we write?
My tears. I don't eat while I'm writing. It distracts me. It's just like tea or water or coffee. Get distracted.
Yeah, and like I don't necessarily like food around my laptop and like the potential of just like getting little things everywhere. But I do know if I have like a particularly like hefty writing day, I will make sure that I like have like a breakfast that is like my favorite or something. Like I'll make like my favorite breakfast tacos or something, just to like make sure that I'm like in a mood that's not like this is going to kill me, but it's like, okay, I'm ready.
Anybody else have a favorite food or snack? No.
My favorite snack, period, is popcorn. Savory popcorn, sweet popcorn, a mixture of both in the same bag. Like, I love all popcorn. And so, you know, I have a block of writing in the morning that I try to get done. And then I usually try to have another block of time in the afternoon. And usually like around 4 o'clock is when I start getting a little bit tired. And so that's when I'll go get like the popcorn that I've been eating lately is like, it's a caramel popcorn plus like regular buttery popcorn. And they're like melded together with peanut butter cups, and it's delicious. The only thing I hate is the bag is so small. So like, really, I need to buy two every time I do a grocery run. But it's sort of like a little reward, a little pick me up at that point in the afternoon when I'm getting a little bit sleepy. But same thing as other people have said, I don't necessarily like keeping a snack at my desk because I'm using my hands obviously a lot to type, and that would be really messy.
I'm a klutz too, so I will 100% drop my cup on my laptop. I also got used to, when I was working full time, writing in 15-minute increments. So that's, even though I'm not working full time, that's how I write. Like I do sprints, and then I have to get up and I walk around because I will get frustrated. And I will 100% knock over a glass of water or coffee. So I just sit alone in my frustration, and that's how I work. Okay, we have one final question here. It's actually a research question. So it says, when you're writing about characters from different cultures, what is your research process to make them as authentic as possible?
The love interest in 1500 Miles from the Sun is Vietnamese. And so like that definitely involved a lot of research, and not just in what Vietnamese culture is like, specifically even in like California, like Southern California, but like what or how like is young Vietnamese culture today. And so one thing I did, besides like looking at a bunch of food, because like I felt like that could be an easy connection of just like bringing characters together, is food, especially because Jules loves to cook. But also I was on TikTok and I like found like different accounts of like Vietnamese TikTokers or Vietnamese American TikTokers that like were just so helpful in like seeing how like young people act and what they were eating and like the little sayings they would say and like just even how they act with their parents and their siblings and how that might be different than like how Mexican American kids act towards their parents and siblings. So I wanted to be able to get like as accurate of a picture of like what that culture looks like to like a 17, 18 year old today. I also just wanted to like make sure that whatever I did was something that I had knowledge in, but also wasn't overstepping in any way. Like, I mean, there are definitely parts of like any culture that you like, if you're not part of it, like you don't want to just put yourself in aggressively. And so I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to talk about anything that like is not my place to be talking about. And so I think you just also have to be just rely on your own, not on your own head of like where that line is, where like you can still create a very authentic culture without like bringing in stuff that like is not necessarily for us to be talking about.
So I had a huge sort of unfair advantage, which I think I mentioned earlier, that I was an ESL teacher for several years. So all of my students were immigrants from other countries, and not just Central and South America, but I had students from Asia, from Europe, from all over the world. And a lot of those students I had for multiple years in a row. I had them for multiple class periods. So we spent a ton of time together. And of course, when I was drafting, I wanted to incorporate characters, you know, not just to reflect the diversity of our world, but I also wanted to include characters that, you know, reflected some of my students. Like Johnny mentioned, having Vietnamese characters, there's a huge Vietnamese population here in Texas. So I had so many Vietnamese students. And so I have, you know, a couple of Vietnamese characters in my book. And, you know, I saw every day the snacks they were bringing to homeroom. Sometimes they would give me some snacks that they brought from home. We would have like these cultural celebrations where everyone would bring food to share with their classmates from their home cultures. Even during the writing of the book, I wanted to include a couple of things in different languages, and I had some students translate for me. So there's some Thai in the book. There's also some Italian in the book, and I had students help me with that. So that was, like I said, a little bit of an unfair advantage when it comes to, you know, drafting future books. I think, like Johnny said, social media, where those people are, especially because we're writing Kid Lit, and in particular on this panel, we're writing for young adults, like being on TikTok and being in those spaces and seeing how they're using them, seeing the music that they're listening to, I think can be really helpful. I think also, even if you're writing about your own culture, it can still be helpful to get a sensitivity reader, you know, just to help you catch things that maybe were missed or unintentional. So I think talking with like a real life human being is obviously the first and best choice. But then also, like I said, being on social media, using the internet to your advantage, to learn more about other people. And then if you are able to get your publisher again to maybe pay for some sensitivity reads, I think that's a good idea as well.
I think I like the idea of thinking of TikTok as research. I do think that's very true, but it's I hadn't really thought about it that way before. But I think the sensitivity read as piece is really important. And when I look at this question, I think a lot about being humble and knowing that I won't get it right the first time. Probably won't get it right the second time. Whose like job is it to make it better? For the most part, it's me, and I'm continuing to do that. But like as authentic as possible, I don't know what that looks like. That's a really high bar. And as Lakin pointed out, even our own characters, what is authentic? But I think that there are a lot of tools that can help that you both have talked about.
Yeah, I 100% agree that you're going to research regardless of whether or not you're pulling from your own culture or not. And research is an amazing tool, and there are so many places to go. For example, for the resolutions, I wanted to make sure that they're for Puerto Rican characters, and I didn't want them to be just all like the same type of Puerto Rican person, because Puerto Rico is such a varied and diverse community. So Ryan is Taiwanese and Puerto Rican, Lee is Afro-Latina, Afro-Boricua, Nora is like Puerto Rican and half Cuban, and so on and so forth. So that was a lot to research. And I also did the same. I also, had a character who had a very serious degenerate genetic disease that I had to look into. And that was also a lot of research and a lot of possibilities to get wrong, even regardless of the history within my family as well. So books were a great place to start. Supporting other authors were a great place to start. YouTube is actually a really good resource. I watched a lot of documentaries regarding the particular genetic diseases that I was talking about. I read a lot of interviews. I went into like deep website holes of looking into opinions and just like personal stories, really, because there are so many variations in everybody's relationship to their culture and to particular parts of their lives. And then I did authenticity reads. Like you got to do those authenticity reads. And I was very lucky that I had very good experiences with my authenticity readers. I cannot say enough wonderful things about them. So I highly recommend them. And as Johnny mentioned, just recognizing certain lines that are just not for you to talk about. Just like, this is like, I absolutely want to show the beautiful and diverse and complex Puerto Rican culture and characters. But there are certain things that it's just like, that's not for me. That's for somebody else to explore and somebody else to put their voice on it. And that's absolutely fine. Even now in my middle grade, it's the first one that I'm actually setting in Puerto Rico and setting literally in the neighborhood I grew up in. And then my grandfather's lived in, and I'm doing a lot of research because things are changing so often. And there are things, even when you're growing up in a place that you might have not been aware of because you were a kid, but that affected you in some way or another. So research is just, I feel like it's a constant. Like you don't ever stop researching and adding and fixing and adjusting. So I highly recommend it.
And I just wanted to add one more thing, because everyone kind of brought up the like ethical component of this, which I do think it is really important when you're writing about characters from marginalized backgrounds that you try to be as ethical as possible. And so as you're doing your research and you're kind of layering in those things into your story, I think it's important to look at what's there and ask yourself, is there anything in my story that could potentially be weaponized against this community? That's something that I have to ask myself all the time about my own community that I'm writing about, because I know what my intention is behind what I'm saying and what I'm describing in the book. But, you know, the book is not only going to be read by readers from my community. So I just want to make sure that there's nothing harmful in there, nothing that people can parse out that they can then use to weaponize against us. And I ask those same questions when I'm writing or incorporating characters who are not part of my community, but who are still marginalized in some way. So I think it's important to have those questions handy, like when you're drafting and revising and incorporating that research.
And I would also like to say that there's a therapeutic aspect of research, I think. For example, in the resolutions, I talked a lot about anxiety. I grew up with anxiety. I have anxiety. I still went ahead and did a whole lot of research into anxiety and the history of and treatments and mental health and all of that, because even something that came from my own experience, there was so little that I just didn't know that I needed to work on as well, so that I could be as truthful to myself as an author and to my character in their story. So I highly recommend research, y'all. And that's our final question. Thank you everyone for joining. If you'd like to learn more about Las Musas or our books, please visit our website at lasmusasbooks.com or find us on social media at Las Musas Books. And be sure to check out our bookshop page, where each purchase of one of our books goes towards supporting independent bookstores. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to our podcast. You can also sign up for Las Musas newsletter to have podcast updates, as well as other Musa news, such as release dates, teasers, spotlights, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Thanks for listening.